The Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio Network, or maybe I should say welcome back to the Progressive Radio, you're on the Progressive Radio Network. This is the Progressive Radio News Hour. In the previous hour, my Saturday program with Adrian Salbucci was repeated. It's archived. Anyone who didn't hear it can go to the archives and access all Progressive Radio programs. They're archived pretty soon after they're aired. Sometimes over the weekend they may be delayed a little bit until Monday, but they generally get up pretty quickly, and it's a very convenient way to listen. People can either listen live if they're available, or they can go to the archives and listen to their favorite programs whenever it's convenient for them to do it. That's a marvelous way to have it. But we're on to today's program. My guest is Bob Abele. Bob is a professor of humanities and philosophy at Diablo Valley College in California. He's authored 4 books, including Democracy Gone and Anatomy of a Deception. It's about the Iraq invasion, occupation, and preparation for the next deception. Well, Bob, I think those were your words, so I'm pretty close to them, and there's no question there's always another deception coming along. And, I mean, we're literally seeing them unfolding in real time if people will just open their eyes and watch and listen and understand. Bob, welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Happy New Year.
Oh, Happy New Year to you as well. So much going on. What's on your mind mostly? It's got to be a lot of things, but if there's one thing you want to start off with, let me let you do it.
Oh, my. I guess I could bracket or put underneath as subcategories the general category of fascism in America and imperialism abroad. You had mentioned my book on the anatomy of a deception. As I go through the process that was used to ramp up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and then what ethical codes that violated, what international laws that violated, and how this is a template for the future, well, we see that going on right now with Iran. And also in Syria, you're getting the same thing going on. We saw it in Libya. We're seeing it with Iran. We saw it in Iraq. We see it in Syria. It's the very same thing. And unfortunately for Obama, some of the things that he has tried to trump up to get us to go to war have kind of failed, like the attempted assassination of the Syrian ambassador through the Mexican cartels and all of that. Some of the things that he's tossed up there, people have gotten a little bit wiser to that kind of stuff because of the experiences in Iraq through George Bush. But nonetheless, he's still ramping all this stuff up. And now we're gunning for Iran and Syria. Now that we've got Libya done, and Nigeria is on the table too, as they're starting to talk about openly. So there's a lot to be discussed, and we can pick any of those countries and go any of those ways to see the U.S. tinkering with its militaristic hand.
Oh,
that's all we have to offer is military, so that's what we do.
That's about it. China will surpass us, according to the IMF, in 2016 economically. They base it on what they call a purchase price basis, what a basket of goods will buy. Amazing. I mean, America is not very happy about that possibility. I don't think they need the IMF to tell them what is possible, but China is definitely gaining on America economically. The only thing America is still number one on, Bob, is, as you know, and listeners to this program know, is militarism, lawless imperialism. A line I like to use often is ravaging the world one country at a time, just sending U.S. forces lawlessly, killing, destroying, torturing. I mean, America absolutely is number one at that, and it just keeps going. And Obama took the worst of George Bush and did what his supporters thought impossible. He accelerated them. and this is the guy we want for another 4 years? Well, I certainly don't want the Republican lineup, Bob. I used the line a couple of times in articles. I said they look more like a police lineup than legitimate presidential candidates. I left Ron Paul out of it, although I am not a Ron Paul supporter for a lot of good reasons. But at least he makes sense on some issues. The others are extremists, lunatics. They want to do everything from bomb Iran, maybe destroy the world. Heaven only knows what they want to do. But I certainly wouldn't entrust the country to them if I had a choice. But I wouldn't pick Obama either. My choice, Bob, is either vote independent for someone you at least have a little faith in, or stay home and do nothing.
And then if everybody that is really involved and committed to political process and development stays home and does nothing, then you guarantee a Republican in the White House. Because the people that would stay home who are really involved in the issues tend to vote more liberal and tend to vote more Democratic. So then you have one of the thugs, as you refer to them, the criminal lineup that gets into office. And then you've got some real problems. Although, you know, I'm still not sure that there is radically significant difference between having a Newt Gingrich in the White House and having Obama in the White House. I mean, there are variations, but, I mean, you just said it. Look what Obama's done. In November, he declared two major policy positions, the military encirclement of China, increasing our arms to Australia by 2,500 Marines and more warships and warplanes as aid to Australia, and also a military front on Russia's borders, moving forward our missile bases into Poland and Romania and Turkey, and also harassing Russia through Libya, with whom Russia was getting a lot of their oil, and Iran now, threatening Iran and Syria. So what else is somebody like Gingrich or Romney going to do except push a nuclear button, which would be devastating for all of humanity? The only person that I can see on the Republican side, and I agree with you, I wouldn't want to vote for him because he's really radical in some ways, but his foreign policy makes the most sense. It's Ron Paul's. Get us out of all these, stop the militarism, and bring all that money back home. Unfortunately, what Ron Paul wants to do is abolish personal income taxes and repeal all regulation like health care and the Dodd-Frank financial reform and scrap the Sarbanes-Oxley bill with corporate governance bill. He goes to get rid of all of that, which makes him really dangerous as well. But where are you going to go? I mean, there's really nowhere to go.
It really is a terrible situation. We have a power structure in the country, Bob. I call it the duopoly power, and that power system runs the country. I've also compared Obama, some of the things that Obama has done, to what Richard Nixon did that a Democrat never could have done. Namely, when he was in office, he opened up China. He went to China. No Democrat would have dared do that. But Nixon did it, so it took a Republican Nixon to begin relations with, back then it was Communist China. Calling them that today is really a misnomer. China is as capitalist as America is, and they have a one-party state, but so doesn't America. They both have one-party states. The characteristics are a little different, but the end result is the same. And the people literally get no choice if you vote for either party. And I agree. I don't see much of any difference between Obama and the Republican lineup. Even on racism, my God, look at the way Muslims and Latino immigrants have been brutally persecuted. If that isn't racism, I don't know what is, besides waging war against all these Muslim countries with more coming. Syria, Washington's fingerprints are all over that externally generated insurgency in Syria, and Iran absolutely is targeted, and I think that is policy, and it could come to a head in 2012. I simply can't imagine how catastrophic a war with Iran would be. Iran is no pushover. They can fight back. They can't win, but they can fight back, and they can cause an awful lot of trouble, including blowing up Israel's Dimona plant, that is their nuclear weapons producing facility? How about irradiating that vast area of the Middle East? If that happened, Iran's got missiles that can target Dimona and literally blow it up. If they're going to target Iran's nuclear sites, why not target Israel's? But imagine the fallout from that. You start irradiating the entire region, besides what America has already done with depleted uranium weapons. Bob, the ideas that flow through the head of policymakers and risking these kinds of things, to me, that is the definition of insanity. These people are deranged.
I think that's a precondition of being in office or in some way. I think you're right, the wartime planners for sure. But, you know, I'm not so certain that America would win in a war in the Persian Gulf if they stayed in the Persian Gulf. That's a very narrow little area, and the Straits of Hormuz are only like 10 miles wide, and that's, the Straits are Iranian national territory recognized by international law. And then every ship that goes in and out of the Straits of Hormuz has to be is escorted by the Iranian military. I think that the Iranian Navy and the Iranian missiles set up on the west side of Iran could inflict significant casualties on American ships in the Persian Gulf and in the Strait of Hormuz. If America doesn't have a battle that's fought out at sea and from a distance, they would not succeed in the Persian Gulf, and they know that. I mean, there's been a lot of back and forth with that, but one of the things that Washington is attempting to do right now, they, in their own war simulations, know that warring in the Persian Gulf or in the Strait of Hormuz or even the Gulf of Oman, they would lose. And so one of the things that they're attempting to do is to pull, not only to pull out of the Persian Gulf a bit before the war, but what they're trying to do is, knowing that the strait could be closed by Iran, they're trying to build pipelines away from the Persian Gulf through Saudi Arabia, like the Abu Dhabi crude oil pipeline and the Hassan Fajura, I can't say that name, oil pipeline. They're trying to pipeline it away from the Persian Gulf because they know of the problems there. And they also know that Iran could very easily strike the oil fields in the eastern Saudi Arabia as this happens. So the United States would suffer severe casualties, lots of casualties, both in Saudi Arabia, Oman, and in their fleet if they tried to confront Iran through the Persian Gulf. It would have to be long range. That means from aircraft carriers out in the Arabian Sea, also from stations in perhaps Israel. They'd have to line up that way, and that's one of the reasons the U.S. is trying to get into Syria right now to set up. Syria is a strategic ally of Iran, and if they can knock over Syria, they can put their batteries in there, too. So if they're going to limit it to a regional war, Iran could win. But if they widen it out and use Syria, if the United States knocks off the regime in Syria, which is what they're trying to get the Arab League to do by that, what was that, the Arab League? It's not the summit.
Yeah.
Who was it that went in there, the study group, the Arab League? Study group that went into Syria and they're not coming out.
Observers, Bob. They have an observer mission in Syria, small numbers, and they're debating whether to send more in because so far the general, the Sudanese general heading up the mission is not sending back the kind of reports that Washington wants, namely to finger Syria, the Assad regime, as guilty of committing all these killings. And he's saying that the regime is cooperating very nicely. And
right.
he's very pleased with what they're doing, and the places that he's visited have calmed down a little bit because Syrian troops have pulled out. Washington is very angry about that, so they want to discredit him and discredit the mission or go to Plan B, whatever Plan B is.
Whatever Plan B is, which is going to engage some really interesting conflagrations here when Russia starts ramping up its military as a response, not just Iran, but with Russia, they're trying to move into their satellites and put missiles in, and they're very threatened as Israel gets armed to the teeth. And so you're bringing in a lot of different forces that are going to be at work here, and you really don't know where it goes. And so I think the first step would be to pay attention to some of the consequences, which obviously our leaders aren't doing, But the second thing is to pay attention to international law. Second, something else that our leaders aren't doing. I mean, you go through the United Nations Charter, Article 2, or Section 3 and Section 4, both. Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928, the Hague Convention of 1899. All of those things say very explicitly one nation is not permitted by law to attack another nation on the basis of a settlement of a diplomatic problem, any other type of dispute, or any type of serious dispute that threatens to break out into war. They're required by international law to sit down at the negotiating table, but the imperialist won't. And that's the United States. Bush wouldn't do it, and Obama's not doing it. There's not even any discussion in the Obama administration, in public or in private, from what's been reported, that we have to follow international law. And that is something that, when you break the rule of law internationally, then you have a precedent for breaking it domestically as well, and hence Obama signs in the National Defense Authorization Act as well. So there's two distinct problems I'm trying to point out here. Number one, the consequences of going to war with Iran or Syria have not been fully anticipated, I don't think. And if they have, they're being kept very quiet in the mainstream media. And I think in particular we have to watch China and Russia and what they're going to do. They've both warned that they're going to get involved if the United States attacks Iran. But then we got to come back to the notion of law. And if we violate international law, we give everybody else the right to violate it. And if we allow our country, our leaders, to violate international law with impunity without us objecting to it, then they can turn back on us through the NDA, the National Defense Authorization Act, and say, well, if you object to what we're doing, we're just going to put you in prison and take away your rights to habeas corpus. You wrote about that, I think it was last week in one of your articles as well.
Yeah, I sure did.
So if we don't cover those two bounds and force our leaders to cover those two bounds, follow the law, and look at the consequences of what you're doing before you do it, we're going to end up with some pretty serious conflagrations that we're going to be creating, and including the stripping of our civil liberties at home.
I really worry about that, Bob. I think there is a very strong likelihood that China and Russia would do what they need to do to protect their Middle East interests, especially China, so dependent on Middle East oil. Russia is very oil rich, but it has business dealings in the Middle East. I don't know whether Russia gets any oil or whether it needs any oil from the region, but Russia has exports. Their technology is of value to Middle East countries, especially Iran. They have close business relations with Iran, and the idea that they would be shut out of that region, especially for China, I think China is willing, now that the sanctions have been imposed, U.S. sanctions that target Iranian oil, target Iran's central bank, that is the conduit to handle receipts, payments for Iranian oil. You shut down the ability to pay, then you shut down the ability to ship or collect receipts. You shut down the ability to ship. And I think China already has said that in diplomatic terms that they're going to buy Iranian oil, and I have a feeling that if other nations drop out and Iran is looking for more customers, China will buy all the oil that Iran wants to sell. Hopefully other countries will feel the same way. India has said it wants to keep buying Iranian oil. Japan and South Korea are discussing it right now. They're not happy about these sanctions. Some European countries are unhappy about them. Europe provisionally went along with the oil sanctions, but they haven't implemented anything yet. And even America's law, Bob, it stated that Obama will take 6 months to implement it, to be sure that friendly countries aren't harmed. Well, how can they not be harmed? You know, if a country's a small oil user, they can always make up small amounts somewhere. But who's going to make up the Iranian oil supply? It's the world's number three supplier. It's either number two or number three in proved reserves. And you take that off the market, you're going to see prices go up. There are so many issues, Bob, and I think another one is that at high levels that we never hear about in public, I think there is serious disagreement on policies about possibly waging another war against Syria and Iran, and I think there are top commanders in the Pentagon who are very concerned about this. And just maybe, dear we hope, Bob, that if push comes to shove, they will just put their foot down and say, we're not going to do it. I mean, you're asking us to walk into a lion's den that we can't win. Can I read a line from a good friend and a wonderful Middle East analyst, and he'll be on this program later in January. He's got a new article, and he calls it the this is Mahdi Nazim Roya. He calls it the geopolitics of the Strait of Hormuz. Could the U.S. Navy be defeated by Iran in the Persian Gulf? Well, he's got a lot in this article, but he says, here's one spot where he says, Iran's military advanced missile capabilities come into play. The Iranian missile and torpedo arsenal would, this is a quote, would make short work of U.S. naval assets in the waters of the Persian Gulf, what basically you said, Bob, where U.S. vessels are constricted. This is why the U.S. has been busily erecting a missile shield. Later in the article, he may get into pipelines, but they're doing other things. Because you stick a carrier, you know, a $1 billion carrier in the Persian Gulf, where in the devil is it going to go? And Iran's missiles apparently can sink the bloody thing. Now, wouldn't that be something?
Well, that's why they got that's why the U.S. got the Stennis out of there, the USS Admiral Stennis. Dennis, they brought it out last week. I think that was the last aircraft carrier that was actually in the Gulf. And on the radio shouts from Iran going, don't come back. We don't want to see your aircraft carrier back here again. I think the United States is smart enough to get their aircraft carriers out of there before they launch anything. And they did that this week with the Stennis. But you brushed up against two things, Steve, that I want to kind of raise here as something to think about. What if Iran decided that, okay, you've got sanctions on us, and now the EU has approved a boycott of our oil, but that they put it off for a little bit to allow people to try to find other alternatives. What if Iran decided, okay, we're tired of messing with this, we're going to cut off all oil to Europe right now, and we're just going to sell to India and China? What do you suppose that would happen? What would you suppose would happen economically in Europe if suddenly their Iranian oil got cut off?
Reverse sanctions, Bob.
Reverse sanctions. And that's what Obama's playing with. He's got his NATO allies behind him on this. But if Iran really decided to be bellicose and provocative, they could put Europe in a financial turmoil overnight. And it's the same with China. This is the other point that you kind of brushed up against that I want to kind of highlight a bit. The involvement between the U.S. economy and China is so intense and so complex that if Obama starts saber-rattling in China's direction, well, China holds over $1.5 trillion in U.S. debt, in treasury notes, in U.S. treasury notes. And each year, they purchase something like $200 or $300 billion more. So if China is forced to respond to Obama's militarism, then they could well sell off a few $100 billion of those treasury notes, and then the U.S. deficit is going to skyrocket, and its credit rating is going to descend. So Obama's playing a very precarious game here. So if he does fire actual shots with Iran, he might get away with it in Syria, but if he does it with Iran, he's getting into a lot of trouble with Russia and China on a couple of different fronts. And if he doesn't fire anything in Iran's direction, then what he's doing is he's establishing a Cold War scenario once again with Iran and Russia and China and perhaps India and Pakistan, definitely Pakistan, in one block versus the U.S. in another block. And so they'll draw it off just like they did after World War II, and you'll have the Eastern Bloc and the Western Bloc. And then we're back to another whole different situation entirely. So he's playing some really iffy games here, that there's no way to determine how America can come out of this as cleanly as they ultimately did in World War II. We're no longer there. This is no longer a World War II scenario.
Oh, it's exactly, Bob. In one of my articles, I quoted an article that Emanuel Wallerstein wrote. He's a longtime analyst. He is a he teaches at Yale. I think he's a I don't know what they call him exactly, a researcher,
a university.
a university scholar, whatever they call him. I don't think he goes by the title professor. He has another title that he goes by, but he's at Yale, and he writes some very incisive commentaries. Does it twice a month. Beginning of the month and middle of the month, and an article, I believe it was in mid-December, he titled it something like America versus Everybody Else. And the thrust of his article was that U.S. policies, instead of making friends, are making enemies. I mean, we're literally harming the interests of one country after another. And, I mean, what are these countries to do? America is bullying them, forcing them to do things against their own interests. They are harmed. A recent example that I wrote about is Pakistan, where America some weeks ago deliberately, there's no question that it was deliberate, just the evidence was overwhelming. They targeted and murdered in cold blood 24 Pakistani troops, injured others. They were stationed on the Afghan border. When the attack began by drones, I believe, the Pakistan military urgently notified the U.S. authorities, the military authorities, that they were attacking Pakistani troops. And the attacks continued. They went on for a little bit, and 24 Pakistani troops were killed. Pakistan was furious. The Pentagon said it was a mistake. Pakistan absolutely rejected it. They basically said in diplomatic language, they basically called America a bald-faced liar, the way you would say that diplomatically, but that's basically what they were saying. They stopped shipping supplies into Afghanistan, which cuts off an important ground route. They want a new relationship with America. And in the article I wrote, I called it Pakistan's toxic relationship with America. For all the billions of dollars in aid that Pakistan has gotten since 9/11, about 18 billion or so, you know, give or take a few billion, the cost to Pakistan has been more than three times that amount. So for every buck they got from America, it cost them over $3 more. They have been a one-sided loser in this deal. The longer they maintain that relationship the same way, the worse off they're going to be. The government is hated for allying with America. There are protests across the country all the time. There are bombings. There are all kinds of things going on. The people are enraged. The military is very upset. I think the civilian government, which is very secondary to the military in Pakistan, I think they fear that they'll be overthrown. I mean, they could be overthrown in a heartbeat if the military wanted to do it. I mean, I just can't imagine how much longer Pakistan can put up with this. Maybe push has finally come to shove and they no longer will. But the same is happening with other countries. How long will these countries put up with U.S. policy that absolutely harms them? And I think that was the point of Wallerstein's article.
Oh, Wallerstein is his name. Okay, I was going to ask you who that was because I don't think I've ever heard of him before.
Oh, I've had him on my program once, Bob, some time ago. I'll have to get him back again. He was a little hard to get. He travels. He does different things. And I had to pin him down, and it was a little bit tough doing it. But I'll try to get him back again.
Well, you're bringing up some really important issues regarding Obama's global assassination campaign and his use of drone. And that's as he said, was it this past week when he said he's going to refocus his Pentagon budget and the new U.S. military to continue to bilk taxpayer dollars and give it to the military with no cuts. But he's going into the drone thing. The U.S. already has close to 1,000 Predator and other drone aircraft. I know that there's at least three different kinds, if not four. And Obama has used it since his first use of it when he came into office was in Pakistan. And the latest debacle is the one that you were just talking about, which has really enraged Pakistan, as you rightfully say. But Obama has used it like 240 other times, the drone assassination, the drone bombing. So we're now going to be doing a lot of our wars, through these drones, which are already, we have drone bases in six different countries in two different continents in the world. And we're running 1,000 drones or better. I mean, Al Jazeera says it's far more than 1,000. They think that's an understatement. But That's what Obama wants our wars to be. And I was reading this article in Al Jazeera that were saying that the United States already has military robots doing military work, on-ground robots, in addition to the thousands, Al Jazeera calls it thousands of Predator drones. So that's the new military, and Obama, that new military doesn't respect civilians, it doesn't respect the laws of war, it doesn't respect any social agreement between countries or people, because nobody can get to them. I mean, Iran did the Gary Cooper thing from the 1960s, shot down a spy drone coming over its own territory, but the drones fly too far up, and they're indetectable by radar, so Obama is using them 15 times in Yemen, 240 times other places for assassination and for warfare, and now it's coming home, because this month the Federal Aviation Administration is expected to propose new rules to make it easier for local and state law officials to get U.S. drones to fly for their police departments. There's no official recognized airspace for that yet. So now they're trying to use it on American citizens. So you're talking about a whole new style of warfare, and the way that it was used with the Pakistani army that you talked about is just the very beginning of what we're going to see happen over and over again, and it's coming back home to haunt us. In terms of us, so far it's only going to be privacy issues, but it's going to go beyond that, and it's going to go beyond that in these countries that were using the drones to bomb as well. There's going to be a backlash from it. It's unbridled violence, unbridled warfare, unbridled spying, and a consolidation of complete military and economic power among a few people with no accountability to anybody.
Boy, that sure is true, Bob. It's a very scary situation. I can make a few comments. Let's take a brief break, and then we'll come right back and pick it up. Very scary times, Bob. On with Bob Abele, talking about the major issues that I know concern listeners to this program, other progressive radio programs, and they should concern everyone. I hope listeners will pass the word on these things, get others, get their friends who may not be as attentive as they are to pay more attention, because literally we're at great risk. I don't ever remember a time in my life, Bob, I've been around a while, I'm certainly not a kid anymore, I left that behind decades ago, and I never remember a time in any way approaching the situation that we have today, where we literally, during the Cold War, my goodness, I never really was worried about either side blowing up the other one, setting off a conflagration. Could have happened, and nearly did once, back the Cuban Missile Crisis. If by mistake, we nearly set off a nuclear war. But now, it literally could happen by design, not by mistake. And the countries that could get involved in it. I don't think Iran has nuclear weapons, but China and Russia most certainly do. And if they get involved, and if they're really, really threatened enough, I would imagine they'll do what they need to defend themselves. Others as well. Pakistan's a nuclear power. We know Israel is a nuclear power, the only known nuclear power in the Middle East. Nobody talks about that. Everybody worries about the non-existent uranium program. And by the way, Bob, in a couple of my articles, I cited the latest U.S. intelligence assessment as of March 2011. This is the consensus of America's 16 intelligence agencies. Why America needs 16, I don't know. Everybody wants their own. So we've got 16 intelligence agencies. Every year they come up with an assessment globally. country by country. In 2010 and 2011, they said exactly the same thing about Iran. There is no evidence whatever that proves Iran is developing nuclear weapons. They throw in a line, it doesn't mean they're not doing it. We just can't find any evidence to show that they're doing it. Well, I think that's pretty proof positive for me, because they are surveilled all the time, electronically, by satellites, by special forces on the ground, CIA operatives, internal spies, maybe Iranians they enlist. I mean, Iran is as closely watched as any country around, I would imagine. Certainly very, very closely watched for many, many years. And nobody can pin down the fact that Iran may have a nuclear weapons program. To me, that says they certainly do not. It would have been detectable, and that comes from the U.S. intelligence consensus. So to say they do and use that as a pretext to go to war shows what we're up against, Bob.
Which, again, means that our leaders don't care at all about the laws of war or about the Geneva Conventions or the Hague Conventions or anything like that. We just do what we want. And the moment that that would be done to us, we'd be screaming bloody murder that there were violations of the war conventions and human rights and all of that. But when we do it, it's okay. And going back to the Iran thing that you were talking about, I think it's important to note two things about that. Number one, according to the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, Iran has every right in the world to process uranium. They're allowed to do that as long as they're powering up their own facilities with that. And like you said, there's not one shred of evidence that Iran is doing anything other than that. And they've even made offers to have their depleted uranium sent to France and sent to Russia. There's other countries that have stepped up and said, well, we'll take it off their hands to guarantee compliance, and the United States has said no. That is an indication of what the United States is looking for. They don't care about Iran trying to do this. They're looking for a pretext to take over Iran. They've been doing that for 30 years. I mean, I remember at least 20 years ago picking up the first article that I had read on United States plans to move in and take over the Middle East. It's been around for a long, long time. We've already meddled in there in the 1950s, and we've been after it ever since. So we don't have anything to go on, so we make up things. So I think it's time that we start trotting out the Donald Rumsfeld quotes. You know, the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence, and things like that that were said, the doublespeak that goes on and the ridiculous comments and stories that go on. It's exactly the same process every time we want to go to war. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a Gulf of Tonkin incident that occurs that everybody gets on board with and says, let's go attack these guys. It's the same scheme every time. Make up stories, make accusations that you can't make stick, get the people in positions of fear and outrage and terror, and then go to war with impunity, and it doesn't matter. I mean, that's what my book a few years about the 2000 Iraq invasion was all about. Here's the template. Here's the way they're doing it. Here's what they're violating. Here's what they're not taking account of. Here's what they don't care about. Now, if we care about this, we have to stand up to this. And there was quite a bit of anti-war movement in 2003, but that kind of died away, and now it's gotten completely muted, although it kind of comes back out with the Occupy Wall Street. But it's the same process, and we'll see it over and over again until somebody puts a stop to it.
Yeah, we better put a stop to it. Well, Occupy Wall Street has it as one of their issues. I think it varies because you've got protests going on in over 1,000 cities and communities nationwide, so they can vary from city, community to one to another. But that is on the list. Their main ones are, the bankers and corporate greed and the economic hardship that people are going through. That's the motivation for getting people angry. You lose your job, you lose your home, you have no idea what's going to happen next. Half the country is living in poverty or close to it. That's according to the U.S. Census Bureau. I mean, people are going to get mighty upset when the only policies coming out of Washington are not to make things better, but to make them worse. Austerity, that's the operative word. When people need help, the operative word, bipartisan approved, is austerity. Plus these imperial wars that go on endlessly, plus taking care of all the major corporations with the bankers at the top of the list. I mean, that should get everybody enraged. I mean, enraged to really want to get out and do something. And people are really hurting. I never remember anything like this. And it doesn't matter whether you've got a Democrat or Republican running things. You've got a Democrat Senate, you've got a Republican House, and you get Obama in the White House. But basically, they all coalesce, and on the big issues, they're pretty much in lockstep. I don't hear any dissent on these wars. I don't hear any dissent on all the corporate favoritism. I don't hear any dissent on the police state laws debate. And then, of course, we've got the presidential campaign underway. All they talk about is who's ahead and who's behind and when's the next primary. What about the issues, Bob? Nobody talks about the issues. I don't hear them talk. Well, I don't watch the debate. I mean, I don't know what they say when they have their debates. I think it's a lot of generalities that don't amount to anything. And it's all prescripted. It's not really a debate. It's prescripted. So they have their lines. They basically repeat them. Do they use teleprompters? I don't know. Do they use teleprompters?
I don't watch those debates, so I couldn't tell you. I tried to watch the first one, and it was so filled with fluff and ridiculous statements. It looked to me like everybody was kind of trying to do a dance so that they looked good. It was like watching Dancing with Stars, except it was done verbally. They were looking to look good without really saying anything that would provoke anybody, and that seems to have continued from what I've read since then. But I don't think that they use teleprompters. If they did, who was it? It wasn't Santorum. It was Rick Perry. Wouldn't have forgotten his 4 points of governance that he forgot one of those debates. Where he couldn't catch. He forgot two of them, and he couldn't come back and get them. He couldn't remember them. And if he had a teleprompter, I'm sure it would have been there for him.
Provided he could read.
Silly, you're right.
you remember when Bush took part in these debates? He was wired, and a rear shot showed the wire protruding from his suit jacket in the back. But they literally wired him, and he had some kind of a plug in his ear. I guess very, very small, so viewers couldn't see it. But they were feeding him the answers before he opened his mouth and put his foot in it. That's the way they took care of Bush. If they get the same kind of candidate in 2012, I imagine they'll use a similar technique. But again, the so-called debates, they're basically prescripted. They know more or less what they're going to say. I think they know the points that will be brought up. And the idea of calling it a debate is ridiculous. Whoever remembers the last debate when real issues were debated by one candidate versus another? I don't remember 1992, Bob, when we had Ross Perot in the race. He was very outspoken, and I don't remember that, but he was in the debates then when at least it was a threesome instead of a twosome, and he ended up with about 20% of the vote, and he saw to it that Bush was not reelected, and Clinton was. Well, I don't know that it made any difference. I think Clinton turned out to be worse than Reagan and worse than Bush won. And I don't know what Ross Perot would have done, but at least it made it interesting back then. But again, no debates, no issues, same kind of stuff. We just kind of sleepwalk through one primary after another and head off to the November elections, where most people will use electronic voting machines to vote. And unfortunately, they're run by big corporate interests, and they can make the vote come out any way that they wish. So Gore won in 2000, Kerry won in 2004, but Bush spent 8 years in the White House, and I honestly believe, I think Obama would have won it legitimately, even if the election was rigged, but I think the system was set up for Obama to be the next president. People were sick and tired of the Republicans, and the Republican ticket to me was a dead giveaway. McCain, Palin, they might as well have nominated Mickey and Minnie Mouse as that combo. It would have made even more sense. And it was so nonsensical that it made a slam dunk victory for Obama even more likely. It won't be quite the same thing in 2012, but I imagine he's going to be reelected, Bob. What's the alternative?
Well, right. And actually, you had mentioned the twosome. I actually think it's just a onesome with two different faces to it. It's kind of a Janus head thing. because particularly if you take into account some of the statistics, the Washington Post, I think it was last week, came out with a study that said that the gap between Americans and their congressional leaders has almost doubled over the last 25 years, economically speaking. I got to think of the numbers here. The median net worth, I think, of the people in the House went from $280,000, I think, in the mid-1980s to it's now like $750,000 today. And over that same period, the wealth of American families has declined. So you basically have a one-party system, the money system, and it's the corporate system. It has nothing to do with democracy whatsoever, but they couch it up in democratic terms, and they put the democratic things on there, like liberty, give me liberty, keep giving me liberty, corporations are people, give us liberty, that kind of stuff. And the one that does that the most gets the most contributions, the one who can put the happiest face on corporate understanding of government, they're the ones that win. And then they can move forward and take over and continue their takeover of government. That goes back to what you asked me at the beginning. What do I think is most prominent today? Fascism, the conflation of corporate power and government power. And you see that in Michigan today, not just in Washington, D.C. That's the macrocosm in D.C. where you have such a gap between our elected representatives who are all millionaires. They're all millionaires, with the exception of perhaps one or two who are upper 100,000-aires. But now they're moving into states like Michigan, where Flint, Michigan, in December, became the fourth U.S. city to be run by a corporate executive. They're bypassing all the democracy that is involved in running a city, and they're running it on the basis of what this corporate goon decides he wants to do with this city. So he makes unilateral decisions, puts in these measures of austerity on the people, and puts his foot on their neck even harder, and they've bypassed democracy, so there's nothing they can do about it, because unless they vote, even if they vote out the mayor, this guy who runs the city, this corporate guy, continues running the city. And that has gone on in Benton Harbor, Michigan, and in Pontiac, Michigan, and now Flint, Michigan, where they're cutting out the public schools, and they're bringing in charter schools and all that kind of stuff. It is a corporatocracy. That is the number one problem that we face today. And tie that in with the IMF, where the International Monetary Fund, all run by the United States, where they have these things that they call structural adjustment policies. And that is, we'll give you a lot of money if you need it, and we know you need it because you're so much in debt, but you have to follow what we tell you to do, like devalue your currency and lift trade tariffs, and you got to cut public spending, and you got to cut education. It all ties together in the same thing. Death of human rights, death of civil liberties, death of democracy, rise of corporatocracy, and they're all interconnected. And they're connected in our imperial wars, and they're connected to Flint, Michigan, and our representatives in Congress, who are worth far more than you or me, and don't even know the pain that's out there like you and I can see.
Oh, that's so true, Bob. That was another topic I wrote about, maybe 10 days, 2 weeks ago, I forget. I called it Money Power Runs America. The study you were talking about was from the Center for Responsive Politics, and the Washington Post wrote about it. The New York Times wrote about it. The Times started off their article talking about a man who went to Congress 20 years ago. He had $100,000 in savings, and he had an equal amount in debt. And the punchline was, and now he's a millionaire. One of 250 millionaires in Congress. You're right. They are so far removed from their constituents, and they make more money besides their salaries, besides their generous benefits. They get inside information that if you and I get it, Bob, it's illegal to use it, but it is not illegal for a member of Congress to get inside information and profit on it. And in my article, I gave a number of examples, including three former speakers of the House who made a mint profiting on insider information, and perfectly legal to make all this money. Dennis Hastert was one that I remember off the top of my head. He had a piece of land. He got behind a piece of legislation that let him be able to sell his land for $2 million that he stuck in his pocket that you and I could never, if you and I had done what he did, we'd have gone to jail if they caught us. But for him, it was perfectly okay. So that's the way the Congress operates. They work hand in glove with the corporate interest. And you mentioned Flint and Benton Harbor. Well, in Italy, they don't bother with cities, Bob. They do it to countries. They fired bankers, fired the elected prime ministers of Italy and Greece, and installed bankers to run both countries. Nobody elected them, but they're the prime ministers now. Well, my goodness, I mean, why not fire anybody anywhere and put a banker in charge? Maybe bankers basically run America, Bob. Doesn't matter what the public face is. I mean, Obama absolutely checks with Wall Street before most likely Goldman Sachs, before he lifts a finger to do anything financial. And if they say, well, they basically give him orders and he follows them. But he won't do anything that harms their interest, or J.P. Morgan Chase, or any of those characters. They're all crooks. They should be in jail, but so shouldn't most of the members of Congress, especially the ones highest up. It's a lovely corrupted system we have, Bob.
And you know that you're making the international connection that I was going to make, that when you go over to Italy and Greece, you see the same thing going on as you do in Flint, Michigan. It's there everywhere. Now, if we can tie that into the worker struggles that are going on. I mean, I think of two stories that I've read recently, the Cooper Tire workers in Findlay, Ohio, and there's a Caterpillar in London, Ontario. That both of those are on strike, and they both have been locked out by their corporate managers, who are requiring from them a reduction in wages from $35 an hour to $16 an hour, and then significant cuts in benefits, particularly health benefits. So the workers say, well, we're not going to do that. So the factory owners, the corporate owners of these two multi-billion dollar corporations say, okay, well, then you're out. And then they put them out. And then they go to their union, and the union officials are in cahoots with the corporate goons who are running the thing. So they come back with this paltry agreement saying, well, you know, instead of cutting your wages in half, we're going to cut them by one-third, and we're going to continue to cut the benefits. That's the best we can get, sorry. But the union officials are involved with the corporate officials, and the workers standing alone. So it's time maybe that we go back and start reading on Karl Marx a bit. It's time that the workers understand that they're all in this together, and that the way that you push back against such a terribly corrupt system, and getting more corrupt if that's possible, is to unite. And you don't unite behind your union, because they don't stand for anything anymore that I can see. You got to unite together in a different form, a different method. And perhaps that's what Occupy Wall Street people are showing us. Here's a different way that we can go about uniting together to push back against this. But it's all cut from the same jib. It's all the same cloth. It's all about corporatism, the 1%, as the Wall Street people call them, Occupy Wall Street people call them, the corporate people who run the show, and everybody else suffers in the meantime. I mean, including that joke of the employment report that came out that we added 200,000 jobs in December. If you look at the breakdown of that, we didn't add 200,000 jobs. We're lucky if we added 100,000 jobs, because a lot of the jobs were 50,000 jobs at least were courier jobs, which were temporary, and they were all gone by January 1st. So they're playing with the figures, trying to get everybody to believe that things are okay, while continuing to take money from the workers and give the workers nothing in return.
So true, Bob. And even the Labor Department, when they come out with their numbers, they say that they're basically estimates, and I forget the exact numbers, but I've quoted them way back a couple of times. Basically, they say these are the numbers, plus or minus a few hundred thousand. Literally, a massive number. So, and then the formula to calculate the job creation has been changed, distorted so much over the last 20 years. And if you go back and if you calculate employment the way it was 30 years ago, you'd come up with an entirely different number than the one we have now. And anyone who hasn't looked for a job in the past 30 days, if they come up on the sample, not because they don't want a job, but because they've looked and they can't find one, well, they're not counted. They become a non-person, so they're not counted in the unemployment figures. And all of the government data are distorted this way. And it's inflation is distorted. GDP is distorted. The state of America is completely mischaracterized. It is an entirely different situation than the official story wants to make us believe. And the bottom line is that ordinary people are suffering terribly. We're just about out of time, Bob. A final thought.
Well, I think that I keep wanting to push in the direction of solutions, and I think that we're seeing some solutions kind of come to pass. There are more and more people who are understanding the value of a worker-controlled employment place, so that this idea that microeconomics keeps talking about the idea of economic growth has to be the be-all and end-all of any corporate entity or any individual person. Statistics show regularly that people don't measure their happiness that way, or they don't measure their own welfare that way. And people are beginning to see the differentiation between how they understand their own good and how corporate people understand theirs. So now you're seeing democratic-controlled workplaces more and more, and I think that's one direction. And I think the philosophy changes to understanding the absurdity with being so obsessed with just constant growth, constant growth, constant growth. As Mark said, that's endemic to capitalism, and if you poke at that issue, you can undo some of the dysfunctions of capitalism.
There are certainly dysfunctions, and they're harming ordinary people. And your point about the labor bosses, the labor bosses are in the pockets. Well, they collude with the corporate bosses. They sit on their boards, and they literally don't give a damn about the workers. They make big salaries. They get great benefits. And the more they collude with the corporate bosses, the better off they are. Labor needs to unite, Bob. You're right on the money on that. Unified labor, forget about the labor bosses, and start going for basic worker rights, the same rights everybody deserves. Bob, it was another great program. I look forward to getting you back again for more of this. These problems aren't going to be going away. We'll be talking about them endlessly, but it's terrific every time you come on, and I greatly appreciate it.
I love having being on with you, Steve. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. And I'll just remind listeners, I always do, that we're on every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. These are live broadcasts. Weekend, Saturday and Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can always listen to all programs archived. They go up pretty soon after the programs air. Today's probably will go up tomorrow, maybe today, and anybody can listen to them. You can go back and listen to older ones that you missed. They're just like this one. Top guests, vital topics. Everybody needs to know them. Spread the word. Protect ourselves. And I hope you'll tune in all the time to this program and make it a regular habit.